Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Dori Shafrir, and along with Kate Spencer, I host Forever 35, a podcast about the things we do to take care of ourselves. Join us every Wednesday with guests like author Phoebe Robinson, chef Samin Nosrat, actress Busy Phillips, and even former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. On Mondays and Fridays, we have mini episodes where we answer listeners' questions on everyday problems like how useful a butt mask really is, how to deal with a petty friend, or how to relax after a long day. So join us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on Forever 35, where we're not experts, but we are two friends who like to talk a lot about serums.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Well, hello, and welcome to another podcast from your friends at Books of the Year. I'm Simon, and this guy here is Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Simon. What a day!
What kind of a day? have you had an interesting day in any way, shape, or form?
Do you know what it
What's
has
going
been?
On?
It has been rather interesting. My social media has somewhat exploded in the last two or three hours, and yes, what a day!
What a day! Boom! Enjoy yourself
now.
It's later than you think.
That's now I saw you tweeting about that over the weekend.
Anyway, if you're wondering what we're talking about, it's been announced that Matt and I are going back to do a Drive Time show on Greatest Hits Radio starting March the 15th from 4 p.m. That's 4 p.m. That's a proper drive.
4 p.m. Yes, it is.
4 p.m. until 7 p.m. Monday to Friday.
Wow, all 3 hours. Goodness me.
How about
that? How about those apples? Yes, I like those apples a lot.
So it's all very exciting. And then you can talk about Liverpool.
Yes.
And
well,
all the time.
It's worth saying that since I left Radio 2, Liverpool have won the Champions League and the Premier League. So now that I'm back on national radio, wait for Liverpool season to go through the toilet. It's all going to go wrong
We're already in the toilet. So, you know, with a miserable team.
Oh, it's not as bad.
Who I predict now will win nothing and play really dull.
Right. Well, I will predict that Spurs will win something this season. I think you will win some silverware this season. Definitely.
We think the hours of radio that we have to now reflect on on Greatest Hits Radio, new hot rockin' Drive Time. Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
And now, 20 minutes still in of the pink. Spurs chat. Yes.
And me singing songs.
Yeah. Wow. Are we allowed to do that on the podcast, by the way, you singing? Is that allowed? Are we okay to get away with that? We're just breaking all the rules.
Also, what I enjoyed posting was the Banana Boat song, the Harry Belafonte, but as it appears in Beetlejuice, the movie, which is just very funny.
Yeah, so. No, it's great. It's great. Loads
so it's going to be very, very exciting.
I think it is. I have had people asking me whether this podcast is going to continue, and I hope it is.
Yes.
Yeah?
Well, let's make an on-air production decision. We haven't discussed this. And producer Ben certainly is not involved, even though he'll probably butt in just a moment. And I can say that, as far as I'm concerned, this podcast will continue.
Hear, hear. That's good.
Are you up for that?
I'm definitely up for that. Yeah, brilliant. And not least because there's some great books out there that I want to talk about. So, yeah, brilliant.
Excellent. Well, before we go any further, Prime Minister, the official sponsor of this podcast.
Yes.
Who I have to say, get it on the cheap. They just send us some pies. It's very good, but I do have that kind of lockdown feel that, you know, in terms of, you know, that who ate all the pies? Well, we did.
I did, yeah. Well, I had, so they sent 6 pies before the weekend, 2 of which are veggie pies. So my wife My wife had two of those veggie pies.
They were good. Jackfruit ones.
The jackfruit ones, yes. Well, I didn't touch them because they're veggie. But I had the steak and ale and the chicken, what was it, chicken curry kind of thing. Very nice. Very nice, yes. They are our official pie suppliers.
Yes, that's right. But I think we probably need more.
Yes, more pies, please, Pie Minister, if you're going to be our official suppliers.
I'm getting messages here from Janine Cummins, who's our author. I don't, does that mean she's there?
I'm hoping she is.
Hi, Simon. Hi, Matt. I didn't know if you could hear me. I thought I was, it's all new to me. So I'm glad I got through.
Wow, brilliant.
Where are you?
I'm in New York, and it is snowing and snowing and snowing.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, thanks very much for joining us. Secondly, do you have a favorite pie?
Oh, my God. That's a really hard question. Key lime, blueberry, pumpkin.
I don't have a favorite.
It is.
Janine has joined us not just to talk about pies, but Janine Cummins' book, out in paperback, certainly is American Dirt. It's already one of the best-selling books of last year in hardback. Now it's out in paperback, and Matt is going to describe the cover that he has in front of
him. Yes, so the cover that I've got is a very fetching blue colour that is dominating the page, and it's sort of like a dappled sky or the kind of blue you see in a swimming pool, or maybe in Liverpool's current away kit. That's what I'm thinking of in that blue colour. But then American Dirt in white, big white block letters, with Janine Cummins at the bottom in black, and in the centre is a sort of gold leaf. It's a sort of representation of a bird, I'm going to say. That didn't sound particularly incisive, but it's basically a bird.
What is that bird, Janine?
Oh, that's a good question. It's funny how many people have asked me about the cover when I had nothing to do with the cover, but I do think it's very beautiful. I think the hardcover and the paperback that the UK publisher has come up with are stunning. And I do like how they go together with the sort of themes of the book. You know, it felt sort of evocative to me when I first saw it, of the feeling that you get when you stand at the border between the US and Mexico. And nowadays there is, you know, along much of that border, there are these very heavy man-made barriers. And yet, there's something quite thrilling every time you go there to observe how nature just sort of mocks the efforts that we make to separate this land that is one big landmass. So you always see birds perched atop that fence, you know, deciding for themselves which way they want to fly that day. Or if you go to El Parque de la Amistad, for example, on the West Coast, which separates San Diego County in the United States from Tijuana to the south, and the ocean, the fence tapers right into the ocean, and you just watch the waves wash back and forth between these slats. And there's something very powerful about that. And I thought that the sky blue and the bird sort of evoked that feeling for me.
What is the American Dirt of the title? And tell us how you came to write this story.
Yeah, so I think, again, one of the things that I liked about that title was that it wasn't so hard and fast. It didn't mean exactly one thing. I think it's quite flexible in its multiple meanings. And, you know, it means lots of different things. And I like the way that the reader can sort of bring their own baggage and project whatever it is they think it means at the beginning of the book. And then that idea may begin to morph as they move through the novel. That several different notions occurred to me when I thought of that title. And it was, you know, that we had this sort of dirty little secret in this country for a very long time, that we purport to be the nation of the Statue of Liberty, you know, send us your poor and oppressed. And yet the way that we treat migrants in this country, particularly migrants, you know, who may happen to be Latino or Muslim, we treat them like dirt, you know? And so there was that idea, but also I wanted to get across the notion that, you know, America means more than just the United States. And there are whole, many countries and cultures who are part of the Americas. And yet we have sort of co-opted that word so that now we've hijacked the cultural connotations of what it means when we say America around the world. In the hardcover edition of the book, there was in the end papers on the inside cover, a map of, you know, North America and Central America. And it was a borderless map that we had commissioned just for those end papers. And it really illustrates, I feel, you know, how arbitrary these lines are that we draw to separate nations and peoples. When you see that it's one big landmass and you see that the journey of their trek that they make along, you know, their route as migrants is all one big place, you know, that's separated by these man-made structures. So I felt like the whole book takes place on American dirt in my mind, because Mexico is part of the Americas.
Okay, introduce us to the lives of Lydia and Luca. So there's a mother and son relationship at the heart of this story. I mean, there's so many things to touch on, but just introduce us to Lydia and Luca and the journey which we follow.
Yeah, so on page one, it's not giving anything away to say that there is a horrific act of violence, a massacre that happens in their lives, and they have no choice, Lydia and Luca, but to run. Pretty much everyone they love in the world is decimated at once, and they are in grave danger, and they have to run for their lives. So the story of this novel is the story of their journey and their survival, and they're really falling all at once out of a sort of really comfortable middle-class existence into the lives of migrants and becoming invisible people. And so it's the story of their journey.
Again, this is, you know, it's like the first reel of the movie. It's the first chapter of the book. So I think it's okay to talk about it. But that the slaughter that happens in the opening pages of the book of Lydia and Luca's family is so, I mean, on the one hand, I admit it was thrilling. It's also devastating and appalling to read. And mm-hmm. It did occur to me, you know, almost by page four, how on earth do you begin to get your head into a space whereby you can write about such devastation so early in the story?
Well, this was the third draft of this novel that I wrote. So it's not as though this structure occurred to me immediately. I spent 5 years writing this book. The first three, very heavy on research. You know, I traveled to Mexico. I visited migrant shelters and orphanages. And I volunteered at a desayunador, which is a soup kitchen for migrants. And I talked to a lot of people on the ground who had really good insight into the sort of real conditions that migrants were facing. I met many migrants who were undertaking this journey. And so all of that experience informed the way the book developed. But it may also be true that my own life experiences, my own experiences of trauma and grief informed how the book developed sort of equally. You know, unfortunately, I'm a person who has experienced really significant trauma in my life. I've written about it before. I have lost family members to murder. And at the time that I wrote this book, I was also grieving the passing of my father. And so, it was not difficult for me to imagine that kind of trauma and pain, because it's familiar.
It is. It's an astonishing opening chapter, Janine. And you said just now that you'd been working on this book for a number of years, and this was not sort of the first draft. Was it always going to start with that attack, with that breathtaking attack, with Lydia and Luca cowering in the bathroom? Was that always going to be how the book started?
No, not at all. In fact, Lydia didn't even exist in the first two drafts of this book. And I know a lot of writers, when they talk about drafts, what they mean is it's kind of the same book that they just go back and revise and clean up. I threw away two entire drafts of this book that were like 80,000 words wholesale into the garbage. I did that twice. And then the thing that happened that changed everything for me was my dad's passing. He died a week before the 2016 presidential election. It was a really, really ugly moment in this country. I felt, you know, my dad died at the dinner table. It was a very sudden, unexpected death. And, you know, it felt like such a dark moment in this country and in my life. I felt like sort of all the decency went out of the world at once. And it hit me really hard. And, you know, I was almost 80,000 words into the second draft when that happened. And I knew it wasn't working. I was frustrated by it, but I didn't know how to fix it. And then after my dad died, about 4 months later, I didn't write for 4 months. I couldn't even read during that time. It was just, I was sort of incapacitated for a while. And then when I began to emerge from it, I dragged my laptop into bed with me one day and I wrote that opening scene. And I didn't even know at the time that I was starting over or that this would be the opening scene of the book. But I think I knew as soon as it was on the page that, you know, that it was the book that I had been resisting for 3.5 years and that it was the book my dad would be proud of and that this was the direction I needed to take it. You know, I had been trying to write a book that was set in the borderlands. The initial draft was not set in Mexico. I resisted that narrative for a very long time. And then when I think, as often happens in our lives, when you have a grief, a really significant grief, sometimes it can function like a springboard. And all my resistance just fell away. I had a very painful new perspective on what really mattered to me and what didn't matter. And this was the book I was going to write.
And as we join Lydia and Luca on the migrant journey to escape the slaughter that's happened at home, what's interesting, I think, based on what you've just said, Janine, is that it's like they don't have time to grieve. They're having to survive. They're having to make all the decisions. But really, the kind of grief that they've gone through would be, you know, and will be life changing and devastating. But because they have to move, because they're in fear of their lives, they don't have time to do that.
Yeah, and again, this is one of those things that I am a believer that, you know, writers should be able to and must be able to imagine themselves into anyone's circumstances, and that you don't need to be someone who has experienced exactly the thing you're writing about in order to write compellingly about it. But sometimes it helps. And, you know, I've had this experience in my life as well. When I was 16, I had two family members who were murdered and by strangers. And the fallout in my family was such that we did not immediately have time to grieve. We had to put that grief away for quite some time while we navigated the horror of the aftermath of that murder. And it was a very informative experience in my life. And I think I brought a lot of that to bear on the writing of this book.
It quickly becomes clear, Janine, in the book that this attack on Lydia and Luca's family has been ordered by the head of a cartel, who coincidentally Lydia has met, not knowing who he is. I want to talk to you about the role of this has been prompted by an article that Lydia's husband has written about this cartel leader. I want to talk about those cartel leaders. And they clearly make these very public displays of violence. And we know the reasons why they're doing it. They're doing it to emphasize to the people that resistance against us is useless, because look at what happens to people who don't do as we tell them to. And it seems their entire MO is about, we want as many people as possible to know about how bad we are. It seems odd, therefore, that they would be so thin-skinned about the coverage that they get by journalists. Surely, any journalist writing about how bloodthirsty, how dreadful these people are, that would be welcomed by those cartels. And yet we all know that journalists come in for a huge amount of, that they are targeted by these cartels. I wonder whether you could talk a little bit about those, about this sort of duality that these cartels have of at one point wanting as many people as possible to know about how dreadful they are, but also wanting to silence journalists.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. No one I've talked to before now has framed it in that way. And I think it's really insightful of you to dig in like that. I mean, I think the difference is, you know, unfortunately, there are some statistics in the book that are true. And this is one of them, that, you know, during the writing of the book, Mexico was the most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist. And that I think it was tied one year with Syria. It remains true that it is incredibly, incredibly dangerous to be a reporter in Mexico who is writing about the cartels. And I think the distinction is probably that they only want the kind of coverage that they want. And they don't want anyone operating beyond the permission that they grant. So if a reporter goes too far in telling the truth about, you know, one of these cartels, as many of the courageous Mexican journalists are doing, they're getting murdered at incredibly high rates.
Was there any voice at all in your head, Janine, saying or urging caution as you... clearly, you're writing a piece of fiction, but, you know, it's based in the reality of many people's experience. Did you have any voices in your head going, maybe I should not go here?
No, not the ones I think you're referring to, at least. I never felt unsafe in Mexico. You know, it should be noted that Mexico is not a lawless place. It's, you know, the murder rate in Mexico is lower than the murder rate in Memphis, Tennessee, for example. The problem, I think, is that when you do find yourself on the wrong side of a violent person in Mexico, there's no recourse. These men have impunity for all intents and purposes. So that is the challenge. But I think for me, going into the writing of this book, I took all due caution in conducting my research and in traveling around Mexico. I was very careful, but I also felt relatively protected by my anonymity. I'm a novelist. And up until this book came out, I was a relatively unknown novelist. You know, this was my fourth book. I had never been published outside the United States before. My previous books were relatively well received, but they were modestly published. And I knew that no one knew who I was or really cared about what I was writing at the time. And as you say, the fact that it's fiction and there is this cartel is a fictional cartel that I made up, I think that all of that stuff combines to mean that I was never really in any danger.
So having described, you know, your relative anonymity, Janine, that's certainly gone now. Your book was picked by Oprah for, you know, which is the ultimate for any author. And so all of a sudden your book goes stratospheric, which must have been head spinning. Then there was a kickback against that. And 82 writers asked her to reconsider, and it became a big controversy. What have you made of the dispute that happened around that, and sort of, I don't know, can you just explain what the argument was about? Those who why did they ask Oprah to reconsider in the first place?
Oh gosh, I like, how many days do you have to talk about this? Because it really is such a complicated, it's such a multi-layered, you know, what happened was a very complex set of circumstances. And some of what spawned the controversy was legitimate. And then a lot of it also, I would say, was not legitimate. And to sort of unbraid all those strands and explain them piece by piece would, I think, is going to take me the rest of my life to try to figure it all out. But in the sort of most superficial way, I think it's fair to say that Latino writers in the publishing industry in this country have been historically overlooked, undervalued, underpaid, and that remains true. And there was also a perception of me that I think was not accurate, as being someone who was looking to exploit that inequity. I happen to be Puerto Rican and Irish. I don't think that's necessarily relevant, but it certainly became a focal point of the controversy, determining whether or not my Latino heritage was valid. You know, so I got to watch my ethnicity and identity adjudicated on Twitter. I don't recommend that to anyone. It was a very painful, awful thing to endure. And it's no one's business what my identity is. It's personal, it's private, it's personal, it's genuine. And also it has very little to do with the book that I wrote. You know, but I think that the conditions were exactly right for a controversy like this to happen, because the inequities are real. They exist. And there was this tremendous backlog of frustration and anger. And I think my face was just the sort of vehicle for that anger.
Mm. I mean, we've talked about some of the issues around this on the podcast before. Obviously, you weren't on it, but John Boyne, when he was on with us last time, we talked then about an author's right, almost, as it seems to me, to be able to write any character they wish from any perspective that they wish. However, that if, you know, for example, some people have written children's books from a perspective of a table, you know, and no one can claim to have been a table. So therefore, anyway, so it is very complex. But he said, if you are going to write, he was talking specifically about writing from the point of view of a transgender character. So he was saying, if you're going to do that, and he decided not to. There was all kinds of issues swirling around. But he said, if you're going to, you just have to put in the extra work and make sure it's extra especially good. However, it falls down to, you know, it's almost impossible to have the publishing industry, it seems to me, without the basic starting position of any author can write any character that they wish. There are certain responsibilities that come with that. But that a lot of people who took exception to your book had clearly not read it, it seemed to me.
I think that's fair to say. And I also believe that, you know, when I characterized my kind of roundup of what I can say about this in a short format, as being very superficial, that's true. Because I don't think that that's actually the hill that most people are going to die on. You know, I think when you really dig into it, most people agree with what you just said and with what John Boyne said previously on your podcast, that a fiction writer must have absolute liberty to write whatever story moves in her heart. And to be sure that you have a responsibility to yourself and to your reader, to do that carefully. If you're going to cross cultural boundaries or gender boundaries and write about a character who's very different from you, you need to be really careful about how you do it. And I think that when you really dig in and begin talking about these things, most people agree with that. And so then you get to like the second layer of the controversy, which are also like, then we get to the third and fourth layer, like we can keep going. But yeah, I think absolutely I agree with that. We have to have that liberty. And it's a liberty that right now I think is at risk. I think lots of editors are nervous. I think lots of writers are censoring themselves because they don't want to go through what I just went through. And, you know, it's problematic. But I do see a future where we resolve this issue and also make a lot more room at the table for these writers who have been, you know, disillusioned up to now, and make sure that we solve these problems of inequity so that we don't have a situation where we are just ripe for another controversy like this to swirl around a writer who is just, at the end of the day, making up a story because that's her job.
But also, and it's important to say this, that you're making up this story after having done a huge amount of research into the topic that you're writing about. And I do want to talk, you have sort of touched on the degree of research you did in Mexico. I just want to talk a little about the research you did into when Lydia and Luca are crossing the border into the United States. And there are small things there that I mean that leapt off the page to me, including the bit where you mentioned the coyotes who are the people who will escort them across the border. They give them minced garlic mm-hmm. to put on their shoes because it keeps the rattlesnakes away. Which I've no idea whether that works or not, but obviously my guess is it's not something you would have made up. It's something that's true. Just talk to us a little about the research you did specifically into those crossings from Mexico into the US.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was actually, I have to say, one of my favorite parts of the book to write because it's so steeped in the landscape and it's beautiful there. The Sonoran Desert is incredibly harsh and terrifying, but it's also breathtakingly beautiful. And I went there. I spent a week in the Sonoran Desert when I was writing that part of the book. And there were days when I drove out deep into the desert and, you know, for hours I drove down the Ruby Road and I am, you know, I live on the East Coast and I of the United States and I have always lived in cities. I think that this was probably the furthest I've ever been from other humans in my life. You know, you can drive through the desert for an hour without seeing another car. And I remember getting out of my rental car at some place in the Pajarito Mountains, a couple of miles north of the border. And I had a trunk full of water and a somewhat working cell phone. I think I had one bar of a signal out there. And it was terrifying to be in that place, even with a car and plenty of water and a phone, because it just felt so remote and so isolated. And I remember standing out there and listening to the wind whip by me and being like feeling the terror in my body of what it might be like to have one of my children there with me and only the water that we could carry. And I have goosebumps just saying that out loud because it was so frightening to even consider. And I know that people are making this journey every single day and that they're dying out there. Which is why, you know, ultimately why I wanted to write this book, because I felt like that was a truth that we were doing a really bad job paying attention to in this country. So, you know, a lot of the little details of the landscape and what things look like and smell like and feel like out there in the desert were directly attributable to me going there and being in that place. And the landscape really did steep into those parts of the book, but also talking to so many migrants who have made that crossing and them, you know, those guys being the ones to give me the tips about the garlic on the boots and stuff like that.
Janine, just finally, I just wonder whether your experience of writing this book, the reaction to the book, on the one hand, one of the best-selling books of 2020 being picked by Oprah, then the fuss and bother, which you've just been talking about. How does it make you approach your next book, which I'm sure is underway, or you've got some thoughts or whatever? Does it make you think, I'm just going to write about a picnic in Central Park and that's it, and it's going to be very straightforward and it's not going to be controversial? Or do you want to go back and get your do you want to get your nails dirty again?
Look, I do not like conflict. I've never been someone, I'm not ever going to look to be provocative, but it's also true that the stories I care about tend to be stories with at their core some injustice. And you know, I have a problem with the idea that more and more it seems like we are suggesting that the responsibility and the onus for writing about injustice should be on people of color. Typically, it's not the people of color who are necessarily perpetrating the injustice. It's, you know, in this country, social justice has a racial heavily racial. And so I think if you're a person who cares about social justice and racial justice, as I do, I feel like this is my wheelhouse. This is what I'm supposed to be doing as a writer, writing the stories I care about. And I am sure that the book that I write next is going to piss people off. And I took a long time to kind of get where I needed to be in my own mind so that I would feel free to write that book without censoring myself. And I think I'm finally there. I'm beginning to work on the next book. And I feel good about it. I feel strong in my own voice. And in some ways, I feel sort of like maybe I'm the most liberated writer there is in this country right now, because I've already been through it. So I'm like, it can't be that bad again. It was bad. So what more can they throw at me? Like, I may as well write the book I want to write, because people who hate me are going to hate me and I will survive.
Janine Cumming's book is called American Dirt. Very shortly, you'll be able to get her Q&A as well. But for the moment, Janine, it's been a pleasure to speak to you, and I look forward to reading the next book and finding out quite who is going to be annoyed by what you've done. Janine, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Dori Shafrir, and along with Kate Spencer, I host Forever 35, a podcast about the things we do to take care of ourselves. Join us every Wednesday with guests like author Phoebe Robinson, chef Samin Nosrat, actress Busy Phillips, and even former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. On Mondays and Fridays, we have mini episodes where we answer listeners' questions on everyday problems like how useful a butt mask really is, how to deal with a petty friend, or how to relax after a long day. So join us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on Forever 35, where we're not experts, but we are two friends who like to talk a lot about serums.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.